and unsurpassed penetrating and perfect Dharma is rarely met with, even 100,000,000,000 kalpas have yet to see and listen to remember and accept. I vow to taste the truth without the Tathagata's words.
Good morning.
Good morning.
You're all to be congratulated. We made it.
We remembered.
Yeah. I always like to say, I remember that one time about 6 years ago, I forgot.
Yes.
And I showed up. Was anybody here there?
Yes.
And people were very patient with me. They were actually doing walking meditation outside. That was when we were at the other place. So I wanted to do the service with you because the Heart Sutra is really, you know, as we get into the dialectics of the Heart Sutra, you know, you can kind of get lost. I mean, I was reading Red Pines, those of you who are following along with Red Pine, you know, he goes on from page to page, you know, he quotes one Chinese teacher and then another and another and another, kind of different perspectives. First of all, coming down on the side of form and then emptiness and form. And after a while, my head was like kind of swimming. I had to go back and read Thich Nhat Hanh's. And I actually recommend, unless you really have a very scholastic, you know, aptitude and interest, you know, you can read Red Pine and Donald Lopez's very detailed, or Kanzi, which is the most difficult. But just start with Thich Nhat Hanh, you know, because it's so accessible. His teachings are so accessible on the Heart Sutra, you know, and how he explains it. But I wanted to give you the service because it's really a heart practice. You know, it's not the study as I'm giving it to you. I'm almost a little reluctant to do it because it moves you so much into your head, and it's really about a heart practice. And the Heart Sutra is really about love, is what it's about. What the sutra is trying to convey is how do we get to the place of where, through understanding, love just flows naturally from our presence and our relationship with everything. One thing, when they were translating from the Sanskrit, you know, they were trying to, there's always an interesting kind of transitional place, and so they had to find the right character, and the character they used for emptiness was the same character for sky. So when you're chanting this, one way to think about this is every time we say form is emptiness, emptiness is form. Every time you hear the word emptiness, think of the word sky, 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 sky. And those of you that have practiced a little bit in the Tibetan tradition know that that's one of the main meditation practices, especially in the Dzogchen and Mahamudra tradition, is sky meditation. You actually go out and lift your eyes and meditate on the expansive nature of the sky, which is an emptiness meditation. You know, the Tibetan tradition is really informed very deeply from it really comes from the Heart Sutra. So, you know, one of the ways to think about the Heart Sutra is that I was reading a quote said that there is no greater harm than not understanding the true nature of self. No greater harm. Because it's from not understanding the interrelation of things that all our suffering and the way we harm others, the way it emanates. So that's what's so important. And there's another book that's so accessible and so beautiful, Pema Chodron's book that I recommended to you, 101 Teachings from the Mahamudra Tradition. And the name of that book, which many of you have, is Comfortable with Uncertainty, which is what the Heart Sutra is. The heart, that title says everything that I'm trying to say. And Suzuki Roshi's book, Not Always So, and the title itself says what I'm trying to convey here. You know, that basically the world, if we can begin to understand and really live ourselves from this place, of impermanence. And impermanence, you know, engenders a tremendous sense of insecurity in us when we first start to really, there's nothing we can hang on to. And that's what this sutra is basically is saying. There's nothing we can hang on to. But if we can become more and more comfortable with that, comfortable with this uncertainty, there's freedom. This is the only way to achieve deep, penetrating freedom in our life, is to be comfortable with this reality. This is the nature of reality. And this is what the Heart Sutra is trying to say to us. And the understanding of the sutra doesn't come from an intellectual understanding. You can study this, but it's really a yogic understanding. It doesn't make any sense unless you integrate it into your meditation practice. You have to come at it through a meditation practice. I mean, yes, it'll help to understand, and we can, you know, study deep ecology, and we can understand the interdependence of things, but we have to feel it and have an experiential experience of the unity of things. And so, in some ways, that's what's most important. And I was reading Suzuki Roshi's book, and I realized 2,000 years later, as I, you know, this is probably the best-selling and most popular book on Buddhism, 24 printings. And as I start to read, I go through and periodically read this, you know, just a few pages at a time. On every page emanates forth the teachings on emptiness. Every page, I just realize again and again and again what he's teaching and emphasizing is the teaching on emptiness. And I thought I'd just read a few to you. Here we are, 2,000 years after the Heart Sutra was presented. Suzuki Roshi is taking these teachings through a lifetime of study and bringing them into the Dharma. He's giving a series of lectures to a group that was smaller than this group in Palo Alto, you know, in 1968, right? So this is the first page of the first lecture that he gives, right? He says, the first thing he talks about is posture. So at first you would think, well, that's the furthest thing from emptiness. And we're talking about something very expansive and very, you know, inclusive. Why would he start with something like posture? Posture just seems sort of so mundane, so earthbound. But that's exactly where he starts. He says, now I'd like to talk to you about our Zazen posture. When you sit in full lotus position, very grounded in the material realm, in the realm of form. Very grounded in the realm of form. When you sit in the full lotus position, and he goes on to explain how your left foot and your right foot is. But when we cross our legs like this, and we assume this posture, you know, with the hand mudra, even though we have a right leg and a left leg, they become one. The posture expresses the oneness of duality. Not two and not one. This is the most important teaching. Not two and not one. Our body and mind are not two and not one. If you think your body and mind are two, that is wrong. If you think it's form and emptiness. If you think they are one, that is also wrong. So this is the dialectic, what's happening exactly in the Heart Sutra. And we're starting to study. Form is emptiness. Emptiness is form. Form is not other than emptiness. Emptiness is not other than form. They're both one, and they're not one. This is a hard concept to understand. Our body and mind are not two, are both two and one. We usually think that if something is not one, it is more than one. If it is not singular, it is plural. But in actual experience, our life is not only plural, but also singular. Each one of us is both dependent and interdependent. We're both dependent and interdependent. So this is the first lecture he gives. On page 90, the more you understand our thinking, the more you find it difficult to talk about it. The purpose of my talking is to give you some idea of our way. But actually, it is not something to talk about, but something to practice. The best way is just to practice without saying anything. When we talk about our way, there is apt to be some misunderstanding, because the true way always has two sides, the negative and the positive. When we talk about the negative side, the positive side is missing. When we talk about the positive side, the negative side is missing. We cannot speak in a positive and negative way at the same time, so we do not know what to say. It is almost impossible to talk about Buddhism. So not to say anything, just to practice it, is the best way. Showing one finger, drawing a round circle, may be the way, or simply to bow. That's very much the essence and the heart of how actually Zen is presented as a teaching. The limitation of anything, you know, that I say. The other thing about that I like about when we chant it and do it this way, I feel a tremendous sense of solidarity. I think of all the people that are chanting this. Every morning there are thousands of people chanting the Heart Sutra, in Asia and the United States. I feel a tremendous sense of solidarity with them, that all these people are trying to elevate their consciousness and their minds to a sense of beyond their small self, of some sense of how do we carry ourselves forward into the spirit of, you know, interdependency. So emptiness is presented to us as something vast, expansive, like the sky, nothing to hold on to. But it also says that emptiness is form. So it isn't saying that form does not exist. It's just encouraging us to begin to look at ourselves and form in a different way, in a more expansive way. So this is incredibly happy news. You know, this is not a presentation of nihilism, that everything is eliminated. It's like everything is connected, everything is full. This is, as I was saying, this is the way that freedom is truly realized, when you no longer have to hang on to your small self. I was thinking, how could I give this lecture to the Tea Party movement, who's so interested in freedom, you know? And the way that they see freedom is to separate, you know? These are the people that are not free, and we're free, and the way you get free is that you separate, you know, when you divide, when actually the Heart Sutra is coming from a place of where true freedom is through connection, releasing, you know, let's get beyond this whole two-party way of looking at things, you know, at least one way of looking at it. So the good news is that in some ways, as we'll see more, the pressure's off a little bit. It's everything is all included in this thing called emptiness. We're all already in one big family. We just don't understand it. We suddenly feel very relaxed and comfortable with everything, with everybody, because that's what emptiness is trying to help us realize. The other side of the coin is that there's some responsibility. There's quite a bit of responsibility, because if we're all connected and we can just relax, we're all a member of the family and we're all here at some level to support ourselves. But the other side of that is that every thought and every action we do affects everybody else, and we have to take responsibility for that. So we play with both sides of that, relaxing and taking responsibility. But again, we have the sense, as we practice, that it's not some onerous task, you know, like we just need to pay such close attention because every little thing that I do affects everything else. It's okay. We're all on this raft together. We're all having this sense of responsibility. And can we, and the spirit is more like, well, can we kind of support ourselves? You know, not that we have to do this all by ourselves. So there was a poem by Huaitai that kind of expresses this. He's at the gravesite of a relative who has died. And I can't remember, I think it was somebody pretty close. And the poem reads, it's a haiku, three lines. The world of dew is the world of dew, and yet. That poem. So the first two lines come down on the side of emptiness. The world of dew is the world of dew. Everything passes, right? Buddha's last statement, all conditioned things. Why do you grieve? I've told you, all conditioned things pass. So the world of dew is the world of dew. Everything is transitory, everything moves. If you see things in this light, we can let go a little bit easier. But the last line, and yet, right? And yet. And yet we grieve. And yet, in the realm of form, we grieve. It's okay. That's part of the equation of life. So, Larry and some of his compatriots, I got a little letter in the mail. I thought it was quite beautiful. He's doing a fundraiser for Haiti Relief, and all budding poets, if you're interested, you can talk to him. I think we have one more day before the deadline. You can write a poem about how Haiti has touched you and submit your $25 application fee or more if you'd like. And that'll go for Haiti Relief. So I was inspired. I sat down and knocked off a quick poem. And I was, since I was preparing the lecture, I was feeling my sense of how, like Huaitai's poem, how do I hold both? So this is what I came up with. The earth opens up. The earth gives and receives. It's easy to pay attention when flowers bloom and the grass displays its splendor. But when the earth turns in its cycle of creation and the ground receives our ashes and pits are filled with nameless bodies and horror, the heart can quake and open to receive what it can of grief and love and an understanding of our common ground. So I'm trying in this poem a little bit to present a little bit what Ty is saying. The horror and how our heart cries, and yet how that moves us in a way of solidarity. So the second thing that is presented, and I'm spending so much time in the first couple, you know, 8 or 9 stanzas of the Heart Sutra, because in the first couple paragraphs is embodied the essence, the heart of the rest of the sutra. The rest of the sutra in some ways is just reiterating and explaining how this doctrine of emptiness is manifest again in all the teachings of Buddhism. It'll start to go through each of the main teachings of Buddhism and show you that emptiness permeates all these teachings. So in that second line where it says, Avalokiteshvara Bodhisattva, when practicing deeply the Prajnaparamita, perceive that all of the aggregates, all the skandhas, and we've been talking about what the skandhas are, these heaps, how they are empty in their own being. So he's talking here about the nature of self. You know, the Buddha was motivated by suffering. He saw suffering in the world. And he wanted to have an understanding about how suffering was created. And what he noticed was that most people have a tendency to move out and to project out what suffering is. But what he said was, and this is one of the key phrases in Buddhism, his definition of what wisdom was if we can begin to really understand the nature of consciousness, the nature of how we receive information, And the way he did this, and his teaching was, around the skandhas. He says, let's slow down, let's sit on the cushion, and let's really see what's happening here. And what's happening is that these skandhas, you're perceiving, you're receiving information, and then you are creating your universe about how you perceive this information. So, and we have this phrase in Buddhism, it's called bringing the skandhas into view. It means bringing, really beginning to see that you are made up of your perceptions and what you do, what your conditioned response is, your feelings, and your what we call the samskaras, which are all these emotional responses that we have. If we can really begin to slow this down, now this was the emphasis on the earlier forms of meditation, right? So he's saying if you can really begin to do this, he was asking us to become incredibly intimate with our consciousness, the fifth skandha. He was saying, let's be very intimate. Let's bring these things as close as we can so we can really understand them deeply. And if we can understand them deeply, this whole idea, we begin to take more responsibility for it because we see how we create it. So this was the earlier forms of meditation, was the emphasis on this. But it's also our emphasis. We need to bring the skandhas into view. This is part of our meditation practice, is to do this. The Heart Sutra is going to move us beyond this, but this is a foundational practice. This is an incredibly important practice. But that line says, these dharmas in their own being are empty. So this is a critical phrase, as we were saying last week, that as people meditated and they took the Buddha's word, they said, yeah, as we become more intimate, we can see that in fact this thing that we think is ourselves is really made up of these skandhas. So we can begin to disimpact this whole idea of self. We don't have to take it quite so personally. We're just a constant flow of our responses to our external stimulus, right? And we can begin to see ourselves that way. Well, just a flow. It's just what's happening. The train's moving on. You know, we don't have to get so locked down into one particular state of consciousness that we have. But there's a limitation to this. There was a limitation to how the emphasis of this early forms of meditation, of just bringing the skandhas into view. And there were two major limitations. One limitation is that if you assert something, there's something that you don't assert, which is exactly what Suzuki Roshi is saying. If you say something about one thing, you're ignoring the other. Right? This is true about anything. If I say this is a pencil, it's already assuming that you're not a pencil, or this isn't a pencil, right? And when we really think about it, this is the essence of division and strife and war. This is my country, and you're not a member of my country. You're not a member of my tribe. You're not. I mean, the permutations are vast. So if you say, okay, we've got to the place of where we're looking at the self differently, but we're getting a little attached to these ideas of dharmas. We've broken them down into dharmas, but we're saying these dharmas have an own being. They have some, these momentary states, they have a particular emphasis, a value that we can say these dharmas are, they're not, because they haven't quite used the word emptiness yet, but they have their own identity, their own solidity. The problem with that is when you say that these are real, it means that something else isn't. And so what the Heart Sutra is trying to do is take the rug out from everything so we can really have freedom. So that was one important teaching, what the Heart Sutra was trying to address. The limitation of just bringing the dharmas into view. There was a limitation to this kind of meditation practice, just studying the Abhidharma. The second one was most important, is that in this kind of practice, you become too self-focused. you become, you sit and you just spend all your time bringing the dharmas into view. You can start to categorize the dharmas. You become very, very intimately focused. But it starts to get too myopic. You're starting to focus too much. You're losing the forest for the trees. You're just emphasizing the trees. You're losing the forest. You're losing the fact that the world is full of love, that the world is full of interconnectedness. And they begin to see, the later meditators begin to see the limitation of this. So in fact, the Heart Sutra really is what it's saying, is trying to move us beyond this kind of narrow way to look at meditation into the fact that world is actually love. The Heart Sutra is actually a sutra that's talking about love. And it's actually very poetic. And if you think about it more as a mantra practice, like when we bow, we're bowing with some kind of devotional feeling, you get more of a sense of what the way this sutra is supposed to be, used. And where it can, it can move you. So it's, even though it seems analytical, actually it's really not, it's not the purpose of it. So that's why the name comes up. The next name is O Shariputra. Form is emptiness, emptiness is form, that which is form is emptiness, so on. So who is Shariputra, and why is Shariputra? Well, first of all, a little bit of a disclaimer. There was a little bit of sectarianism in this. You know, in other words, one school is beginning, they're doing exactly what they're trying to get around, which is, we've got a little better point of view than your point of view. Okay, so I just need to let you know that's happening here. But that's good, right? It's just because even in the most pure of doctrines, you see the hint of that, right? So Shariputra was a Brahmin, born to high class. And he set upon the journey, which was a popular journey at that time, the same as Buddha's, of like trying to seek truth. And he studied with a bunch of teachers. And as he was walking along, he came across a teacher, and the teacher talked to him about Buddha. And the teaching he gave him was, of what arises from causes, the Buddha shows how it begins and also how it ceases. So basically, in that one sentence, he's presenting to him the doctrine of co-origination, which is one of the heart of the teachings, and of which, in other words, everything is a result of conditions, right? Everything arises because of conditions, and everything passes away, which is the heart of the emptiness teaching, actually. And so he got Shariputra. Shariputra went, and it says that even after 2 weeks of an intimate study with the Buddha, he actually obtained the highest realm of realization. Which it wasn't so easy to do. I mean, Ananda, who was a Buddha's disciple, studied with him for years and years and never didn't attain that until actually after Buddha died. And so Shariputra was sort of Buddha's right-hand person. He would often turn to Shariputra and say, would you give the lecture? Would you? So that often the sutras are taught through Shariputra because he was the embodiment of wisdom. He understood the skandhas better than anybody. He had deep wisdom into the nature of how the skandhas operated. So he was the one that represented this. So Avalokiteshvara is turning to Shariputra and saying, this is good, we need this, but I want you to take it a little bit further. I want you to look more deeply into what the nature of what really the permutation of what this is around the skandhas. The thing about Shariputra also, that he actually died 6 months before Buddha died. I just think, you know, Buddha lost his son, and Shariputra, his main disciple, before he died. So he experienced, you know, he had to work around issues of impermanence. And he lost his mother when he was 2 weeks old. Well, that's a lot of loss in somebody's life. So what Shariputra was saying is that, okay, I'm the best person, I'm the wisest person, I really understand. So when you study, we say there's, if you really pay attention to the skandhas, you'll notice that there's 75, all of reality is divided into 75 categories. And 72 of them are called conditioned skandhas. In other words, the realm of which we're made in the universe is made up of, it's all conditioned. It's conditioned by our karma, it's conditioned by how we think about things. But there are three states that are unconditioned. One is the unconditioned dharma of space, before the idea of emptiness came in, space. The other two are nirvana, when Buddha was enlightened, he was able to get to a place where he wasn't creating any more karma, and he entered nirvana, in this state of a presence and transcending his conditioned reality. That's the second form of unconditioned dharma. But there were remnants of karma because he had this karmic momentum from the early part of his life, right? And so that was still being played out. That's why he died. And he suffered. He had physical pain, right? Then the third form of unconditioned dharma is parinirvana, which is when the Buddha died, all his karma was exhausted. And he ceased the wheel of... He could then just be completely... That means completely at peace. So what happened with early Buddhists in the Abhidharmic system that Shariputra was the master of, they did exactly what happens in most religions. The conditioned dharmas are kind of impure, right? The unconditioned dharmas are pure. This world in which we live is impure. We can clearly see that. We die, there's suffering. But we create a realm called heaven. They didn't call it heaven. But this unconditioned dharmas were more where it was at. This is not where it's at. This is where it's at. Right? We need to get to the place that's unconditioned, which is on one level true. The more unconditioned we are, the very basis of psychology is trying to get more aware of our conditioning, right? But you can see that it sets up a dichotomy, right? Can you see the duality that's set up here? In other words, this is not so good, and this is good. Earth is not where it's at. Heaven is where it's at. And that creates all kinds of problems when you start to get into this. So what this teaching began to do is it said, no, even not only are unconditioned dharmas empty of an own being, but conditioned dharmas are empty. We're going to destroy the distinction between these two categories. And what happens is when you do that is that you no longer are operating in a dualistic system. You are operating in the system of oneness, that we are all in this category of oneness. Everything is included. When everything is included, you don't have to push anything out. You don't have to push anything out. And if you more and more lead your life from that, you can see what incredible freedom comes from that. So you meet people like Gandhi and Martin Luther King and Buddha, and a lot of teachers I met that actually come from that place. Even people they don't like, they don't push them. Even people that are pretty bad, they don't push them out of the circle. Somehow, everything's workable. Everything at one level is interconnected and supporting one another. And more you see deeply into the nature of that reality. And this is what the Heart Sutra is encouraging us to do, is to move more and more. So Zen, the emphasis of Zen, is really based on this non-dualistic reality. This is a little different emphasis. You don't find this emphasis in traditional Theravadan teachings. Theravadan teachings still emphasize a lot bringing the skandhas into view, viewing the skandhas. Zen says, that's fine, that's great. We can do that. But our emphasis and our meditation is really emphasizing more this non-dualistic state of oneness. So the consequence of that is permeated through all the teachings. That's why I wanted to bring you the teachings of Tsuki Roshi. As you can begin to see it, it's moving you into the state of inclusiveness, of don't push anything out. Now, this creates a lot of tension for a lot of people because there are a lot of things that we don't like, and we want to put it outside the circle. Zen is always trying to bring it into the circle, right? Even states of mind that before would have been not healthy states of mind, even then we bring them within the circle. So what you have is you have teachings like when I give you a koan. All the koans are trying to demonstrate this. Like our one that we like, or I like, the, you know, Zhao Zhou's The Bowl. Please, I'm here to study with you. The outside world, I don't want to be, you know, I don't want to be a president of a bank or a merchant. I'm interested in the spiritual life. I want to study the nature of how my mind responds to things, that I'm creating the world. Zhao Zhou, how do I do it? Give me a teaching about this. Give me a teaching about how I can be more perceptive around this. Have you had lunch? Well, yeah. I mean, yeah, I had lunch, but we'll go wash your bowl. So it's right back into the realm of form. It's like this is not different from the holiest reality, from the deepest kinds of emptiness meditation that you can do. This bowl right here, this world that you are in, not the world out there, not a perfect world that you're going to create, not a perfect you that you're going to create. This you right here with all your defilements is emptiness because it's connected with everything else. And once we live ourselves from that place, there's a tremendous sense of equanimity and compassion that we have. Everything is compassion. Everything is compassion. Everything is this sense of understanding and appreciation. Okay. We're at line 6. But it'll go a little faster. Because we'll start to just move it through some of the teachings. So I hope this is going okay. All right. May our intention equally penetrate every being and place with the true merit of Buddha's way. Beings are numberless. I vow to live for him. Delusions are inexhaustible. I vow to end them. Dharma gates are boundless. I vow to enter them. Buddha's way is unsurpassable. I vow to end them. So let's see, a couple of announcements. We'll have a one-day sitting next week. It'll till about 2:00, and we're going to continue with a newly formed tradition of serving lunch. Deborah and Jim are going to bring lunch, so it's important that people sign up so we know how much lunch to make for people. And it makes it much more seamless. It's really nice. And we'll do some little meditations on the Heart Sutra next week. And this will be the last half-day sitting we'll have for a while because there'll be the 2.5-day retreat. So we won't have one. We won't have one in April. We won't have one in May. I'm not sure we'll have one in June. And I'll be gone on a pilgrimage in Japan most of July. So I encourage you to sign up for this. And the other announcement is a workshop. Susan and I will be giving a little Dharma talk on the 11th of April on Jizho. And then, Susan, you want to say a bit more about that? What you're going to do around that at your studio?
Well, there are some brochures on the table that tell a little bit more about it. And for